This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. With me is Rion Scott, and he is a star in the horizon. He's a really new talent being recognized in the world of literature, and we're so happy to have him here. Rion, welcome.
Thank you.
And it's Rion Scott.
Amilcar
Scott. With a name like Rion Amilcar Scott, you had to be a writer. I mean, what else could you have been? That's just perfect for bookmarks. Well, you are here because The Poet and the Poem usually just features poets. But sometimes when a writer captures our imagination, we bow to fiction. And so we bow to your fiction today, because when it has the energy, imagination, and elevation, and truth that poetry has, we want to meet you. Do you know that you own all those qualities?
It feels good to hear that, because it does start with poetry for me. I think of myself as a failed poet more than anything else. I started writing poetry as a kid, and to be recognized by poets is really the highest honor for a writer, I think.
Well, I want everyone to know some of the honors that you have. I think your newest book is The World Doesn't Require, right?
Doesn't Require You, yes.
The World Doesn't Require You, that's Norton. Boy, yes. That is not as good as it gets, Rion. And you were a finalist for the Penn Book Award for that book?
Yes, Penn Jean Stein, uh-huh.
And the winner of the 2020 Towson Prize for Literature with that book. Your debut story collection, Insurrections, was the University Press of Kentucky, and that was the Penn Bingham Prize for Debut Fiction, and the 2017 Hillsdale Award from the Fellowship of Southern Writers. Do you always have to win two awards at once to be happy, Rion? And you've been published in The New Yorker. Surely you know someone on the editorial staff. That is very big. Very big.
I don't know anyone on the editorial staff. It was a big surprise for me after years of trying.
Really? Was that a short story?
Yes, called Shape Ups to Delilahs.
You know, for someone so young, you have covered a lot of territory. And I would like to ask you, first of all, what is fiction?
Well, I guess to me, it's very simply trying to get at the truth of something by making up the details, you know, getting at the core of our emotion, of our emotional world, by skewing facts.
I think that is perfect. By lying a little, right?
Lying a little, yeah.
That's what Sterling Brown said. He's just a big liar. All writers have to be. But your work is so fearless. Are you aware of how much courage you have?
You know, I don't think of it as courage, you know? I think every day of... I have ancestors that I'll never meet or never know their names or their original names, and presumably they survived slavery. Yeah, that was courage. My parents are immigrants. They came over here to go to college, just leaving their homeland. Neither of them had left the island. They left Trinidad ever. Just leaving everything they knew to start over. That's courage. I haven't done anything like any of that stuff, so I don't think of it as courage. I'm taking from those ancestors, and my mother and my father, and building on that.
Well, you have given a perspective, a really proper perspective, for what courage is. However, there is something such as imaginative and emotional courage, which means that you don't judge your characters.
Mm.
You know, you don't put up any camouflage. You show their wounds, you show their longings, you show the cruelty, you show the love, the loss. So just so that people know who you are, set us up and give us a little reading from one of your works and tell us a little bit about it, please.
Okay, so this, I'm going to start off with a story, the opening of a story called Good Times. It's the first story in my first collection, Insurrections. And it's probably one of the last stories that I wrote for the collection. And it's about a guy who's going through an emotional, a really heavy emotional time. And I remember writing this. I was working at Bowie State University at the time, and I remember I couldn't afford to pay the parking fee. And I remember I was daydreaming this story from, I had to park in the guest parking. It was a long walk from my office, especially in the winter. And I was daydreaming this story all the way from my office to the guest parking. And then, you know, part of it came in a dream. And then when I wrote it, it was nothing like the dream, but it's sort of the core of it. Walter caught the sight out the corner of his eye one hot July day. And for so long afterward, he asked himself, what if he had never seen those dangling legs from the balcony above, kicking, kicking, kicking against the open air? He watched them first with confusion. What an incongruous vision. A man's legs in baggy black jeans, flailing against the open blue of the sky. He watched next with interest and then with terror when he heard the gagging and hacking, a man hanging, a man dying. Laura, Laura, Walter called. Laura, come. Laura, come. Laura, come now. She didn't answer right away. He wondered whether maybe she hadn't forgiven him their last argument the hour before. He couldn't recall why he had shouted and dismissively waved his hands at her. When she didn't respond, Walter figured his voice was making her nerves twitch, and she was turning up the television and ignoring him as she did when the neighbor's baby wailed from above. Those legs, those kicking legs. When Laura came out onto the balcony, Walter was already climbing a stepladder, the biggest, sharpest kitchen knife in hand. Laura, he called, come and help me. What do you want me to do? Don't just stand there. Grab his legs. Grab his legs. Laura gathered the man's legs in her arms and dragged his body over the railing. He pulled and jerked her from one side and then the other. Hold still, she said. Stop kicking. It's going to be all right, she said, though it was obvious that things wouldn't be right anytime soon.
Wow. Talk of that is a cliffhanger for sure. Is that in your first book?
Yes. First book.
And you daydreamed that as you walked from the parking lots.
I daydreamed that as I walked.
So I would say it was a blessing that you didn't get free parking. You should thank the president. But do you still teach at Bowie?
No, I don't. I teach at University of Maryland now.
Oh, when did you switch?
Oh, about 2 years now. So my job has been during the pandemic, unfortunately.
I see. And you're doing all virtual?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What are your classes that you're teaching?
I'm teaching mostly creative writing classes. I teach some literature classes. So creative writing workshop. And I recently taught a class on flash fiction, another class on imagined Black worlds, authors that do as I do, my forebears who created their own towns.
Oh, did you imagine that curriculum yourself? Are you allowed to create your own courses?
Yeah, the literary courses are things that have fired my imagination, and I've written a lot of flash fiction, which is the closest I'll be to being a poet.
Maybe we'll be interviewing next about your poetry. So you better step up, get ready, shine up. Well, what is flash fiction? What's the difference?
Flash fiction is stories that are very short. The cutoff is usually 1,000 words. So a lot of them read very close to prose poetry.
Well, that's interesting because your language is so electric and so energetic that it verges on what we want in the line. So we call prose poetry, if it's margin to margin, we say it's if it has lyric within the line, you know, kind of sprung lyric within the line, so that there's a little bit of movement or tension. It's not just flat. Mm-hmm. So do you think flash fiction has that as well? Or all good fiction, really, right?
It can. I think the difference is that flash fiction would bring in some of the elements of the traditional elements of character, plot, and that sort of thing. Since it's so short, you can pick and choose from the elements. To me, that's not even a satisfying demarcation from prose poetry, because some prose poetry does that. But I think the idea of bringing in that lyric is one choice that flash fiction writers choose from off of a menu of choices.
But I want everyone to know that Rian Amilcar Scott was raised in Silver Spring, Maryland, and had an MFA from George Mason, won the Mary Roberts Reinhardt Award, a Completion Fellowship, an Alumni Exemplar Award, fellowships from Breadloaf, Kimileo, Colgate Writing Conference, Maryland Individual Artist Award, and teaches now at the University of Maryland. Let's hear another piece, please.
Okay. This is another opening piece. This is a piece that opens my second collection. And it's called David Sherman, The Last Son of God. And you mentioned George Mason. I remember this is the first piece that I wrote after I graduated from George Mason, after their time of not really writing very much, because a graduate program can just be so overwhelming.
Who was studying there? Who was your teacher?
The late Alan Schuss, Courtney Brickett, Susan Shreve.
Wow, did you actually have moments with Susan Shreve?
I did.
Alan Schuss?
Stephen Goodwin, yes, yeah.
That is really, because they are as good as it gets, really.
They're really great professors, you know. They really opened my eyes and showed me a lot of different ways to approach this. So the idea was to bring in a character that already existed. So I chose God. God is from Cross River. Everyone knows that. He was tall, lanky, wore dirty brown clothes, and walked with a limp he tried to disguise as a bop. His chin held a messy salt and pepper beard that extended to his Adam's apple, always clutching a mango in his hand. Used to live on the south side, down under the bridge near the water. Now there's a nice little sidewalk and flowers and a bike trail that leads into Port Yuga. Back then there was just mud and weeds, and he'd sit there barefooted, softly preaching his word. At one time he had 100, maybe 200, some say up to 500 or even 1,000 people listening. But the time I'm talking about, he'd sit with only one or two folks, always with a mango, except during Easter time, when he'd pass out jelly beans to get people to stop and listen. He lived on the banks of the Cross River until one day he filled his pockets with stones and walked into the water and sank like a crazy poet. He wasn't insane. It was all part of God's plan. Last time he was crucified, this time drowned. Anyway, God can't drown. He'll come back. Perhaps to oversee the writing of another testament, or to judge the living and the dead, whatever he feels.
That is the beginning of the story?
Yes, that is.
And not the whole story. So just give us a hint. What happens?
The story is mostly about God's son, who becomes a great musician and invents his own type of music after a lot of trials and tribulation.
What's with a mango?
I just love mangoes, so. You. I mean, I imagine I was probably eating a mango that morning, but it's probably my favorite fruit. Coming from, my parents come from Trinidad. They always took a chance to buy mangoes, and then when I visited, it's a completely different world. The mangoes were just so much better over there.
Oh, that is really good. Are your parents still in this country?
My mother passed. About two years ago, and my dad, he's in this country.
I see. Well, I think that they would be very proud and are very proud of a young man who, well, did at 5 years of age, did you say, I think I'll be an award winner for short stories? Did you say that at 5 years of age?
No, but I just love listening to my grandmother tell stories. And I think that's probably where it started. Yeah.
So tell us more about that 5-year-old child.
Yeah, he just had a wild imagination. You know, I took playing with toys very, very, very seriously. You know,
Oh, that's a great line. That's a great line. Think of that one. Write it down.
I really did. It was I imagined, I don't know about five, I don't know what age this was, but I imagined I had my own television station. So I would always have to begin playing at the hour or the half hour. And you know, if my mother or someone was talking to me or kept me from, you know, from beginning at say noon, I would wait until 12:30 to play, because you know, that's how shows were.
I love that structure.
And
I had
a constellation of characters that were just always expanding.
Now, in your stories, there's a lot of television watching.
Is there? I never picked up on that.
Oh yes, and in your selected stories that I see on your website, which I think give everyone a wonderful taste of your writing, the dialogue is so crisp. It is so shockingly real. And I think, do you write in a zone, or are you a very methodical person who collects images? Do you have a bunch of ingredients on your desk, or do you just see it like a film?
Yeah,
or all of that.
I think it's all of that. I feel like it changes for every project. And the realities of my life. You know, I really like the writing that I enjoy most is being in that zone. I find that harder and harder to achieve. Recently, you know, during at the beginning of the pandemic, when everything was just anxiety all the time. Like, you know, am I gonna breathe in COVID? You know, we didn't know anything about it. I couldn't write, so I started writing sentence by sentence. You know, I would just you know, daydream a sentence, or I meditate, a sentence came to me, and I would just write down that sentence, and I'd figure I'd stitch it together later. And I wrote a couple stories that way.
Do they turn out well?
They turned out well. Yeah.
You know, that is the biggest lesson you could have said, because a writer writes. Writer writes. It doesn't matter, even if we're in pain, even if we don't have an inspiration. As you say, just put anything down, and it will work, because it's all from you.
Mm-hmm.
It's all from the same source. And I think that is the best thing you could have said today, that when you couldn't write, you wrote. When you couldn't write, you wrote. I just love the idea of that little boy starting on the hour and ending on a half hour. And because that shows a creation of a reality that this child wanted to operate in, created a bubble, a universe of his own. And that is the definition of an artist.
Thank you.
Yes, and you are really an artist. So what do you want from writing? I mean, writers, they manage, they create, they present, they feel things, they create, they present, they feel things. What is this? What is it all about?
Yeah.
What are we doing?
On a basic level, I'm writing this imagined history of this town that I invented called Cross River, Maryland, found in 1807. I'm thinking of this as this one long saga, and every day I think of, I just want to finish the Cross River saga in the way that August Wilson finishes 10 play cycle before he passed. You know, that's what I really, that's on a basic level, that's really what I want, to finish the Cross River saga.
And where are you in your journey?
I don't know.
How much have you accomplished?
Well, just two books, you know.
But how many do you think are in you?
I don't know. And I envy August Wilson when saying that I'm going to do 10, because I think that provided a structure. I don't have that structure. And it's something that I've been thinking about for a very long time, and I haven't been able to figure out.
You think August Wilson had the end game in sight when he was writing?
Well, you know, I've read a lot of stuff about him. I think that I think he said that after two or three, he realized that he had written from in different decades. So then he decided, oh, I'm going to continue on writing the rest of the time in different decades. So I think I don't think he started with it. I think it came to him after some time.
So that's your inspiration.
That's one of my inspirations. Yeah.
You know, one thing about your craft is that it's an endless world, isn't it? Anything can happen.
Yeah. And it's funny because I was thinking the other day of a story that just didn't seem like it would fit in because it had elements that were just even too fantastical for my world. But then in the background in my head, my mind kept working on it, even when my conscious mind gave up on it. And I figured out a way to make it work. But that's somewhere down the line.
Trust your nighttime mind. That's all I have to say. That unconscious is working for us every minute, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I love my unconscious. I trust it. And the thing about your work is it verges on fantasy. I mean, it is reality, but the best reality is tethered in fantasy because it's like, what if? What if? And I know you like science fiction as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a borderline. In your short stories, you have real people on real places, playing real chess, playing real basketball, throwing real stones at homeless people. I mean, you know, you have a situation. But I cannot say enough that I believe character makes situation. Would you agree with me?
I definitely agree with that because I think early on when I couldn't figure out where to go with the story, I even now I think, you know, my guiding principle is you put two characters together, something's gonna happen. You know? Yeah. So whenever I'm stuck, it's just like put two characters together and see what comes up from it.
But they can't just be average characters, right?
No,
they have to be epitomized. They have to have lots of layers.
Yeah, as any human being does.
There you go. The thing I like about your work is, well, I can't play chess, but when I read your story about the chess, what's the title of it?
202 Checkmates.
Right. I understand everything that's going on in that story. And that is the way I measure excellence, because you don't have to know the game, do you? To follow.
No. I mean, I wrote that because I love chess, but I'm just not very good at it. So that was my effort to get into something that I'm never going to be very good at.
But it looked like you were good at it. You had all the moves, and it was a powerful story. It is about despair and hope, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think that those two characters, the father and the daughter, you know, he's given up, and the only piece of hope he has is playing with his daughter, and then you know, she's winning, and she's all hope, you know, she's all hope, and they have to meet somewhere in the middle.
His hands. If anyone wants to teach detail, they need to read that story. The way you describe his hands brought tears to my eyes, really, because they told his life story.
Mm.
Do you want to say a word about that?
Yeah. I think that just comes from observation. I think, you know, I was thinking the other day, you know, hands are tools, you know, and we treat them as tools. And so we really have, they really do, they take a lot. They take a lot of abuse over time, and they can, you know, they tell stories, you know.
Everything we do is an idea. You're telling us that. Every experience. That's the thing about writers. They live twice. Because they do something and they use something.
Yeah, I think you have to gather everything that happened to you and use it in some way.
Notice. That's the only difference between writers and everyone else. They notice everything. They have to. And I just know you're a fabulous teacher. I can just tell. Let's hear something more. This is Rian Almacar Scott, and he is already on the horizon with short stories, winner, finalist for the Penn Book Awards, a winner of the Towson Prize for Literature, being published almost every, how many books do you have?
Just two.
I thought it was three. So the just two, some people would live to have just two. Okay, give us a piece of your writing.
All right, this one is called The Tragedy of Jardin the Axe Wielder. And it's a story within a story. It's part of a novella called Special Topics in Loneliness Studies. And there is a character who is writing these fables that he made up, that he's pretending are real. And he teaches it to his class as if they were, as if it's something that he discovered. The Tragedy of Jardin the Axe Wielder. Sometimes the trees speak these words, but most of the time they don't speak. It is said that they only speak when there's a breeze, but I know that to be untrue because I hear them most often when the air is still and sad. This is a story the trees told me on a warm day in which the air sat atop us, unmoving. The older trees of the wildland spoke of Jardin the Axe Wielder because they knew him and loved him. They knew the others as well. And they also loved them, but not as they loved Jardin. They knew him as a baby, back when his hands were too small and undisciplined to wield axes. The trees only knew the others after they had become adults and had felled enemies with knives, with fire, with muskets, with hammers, with poison, with hoes, with pitchforks that once baled plantation hay, with flat, heavy chunks of wood run through with nails, with bare hands weaponized and remorseless. The others laughed sometimes and even spoke and moved with joy, but the trees could divine sadness beneath those smiles. The others climbed the trees and sat for long stretches, armed and often alone, looking out on Cross River, watching for signs of trouble from the white aggressives who lived beyond their borders. Brah, they'd bellow as a war cry, or they'd roll their tongues in their mouths as idle conversation, and this was their true language. Not far from any joy they had was the horrors they once lived with as part of the mundanity of life. And not far from those horrors were other horrors, the horrors they had to commit to become free. The Council of Three spoke just before Jardin's birth, back when Cross River was a newborn thing, still covered in the blood and afterbirth of insurrection. They said, "We are the blood-drenched, but our children don't have to be." The Council of Three is no more, murdered by men whose souls will forever burn in various eternal fires. But when they lived, they were murderous, ill-intentioned men. Their souls remain soaked in rivers of red, more blood than anyone will ever need. The same could be said for the Council as well, but also for so many of Cross River. I think I'll stop there.
That is the voice of Rian Almacar Scott, whose fiction is like poetry. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund and the Rivada Fund from the Logan family. I am Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.